Debussy's compositional life. His opera, Pelléas et Mélisande, part of our season, Debussy's Paris, here on BBC Radio 3, marking the centenary of the composer's death this weekend. Now, Pelléas et Mélisande is a piece that Debussy said would stir up catastrophes. And the catastrophes it releases are dramatic, emotional, and musical. This is the largest piece that Debussy ever composed, and the opera has cast a dark spell over its audiences and the entire genre of opera ever since its premiere in Paris in 1902. And that's thanks to the new kinds of vocal writing and the new worlds of feeling that Debussy conjured in his score. Based on Maurice Maeterlinck's play, the piece is simultaneously an apotheosis of late romantic and symbolist feeling. Every note of its five acts is exquisitely calculated to subsume us in a world of pure, disorientating sensation. But it's also a work that's still strikingly and even shockingly modern. The psychological torment of the characters hints at some nameless atmosphere of horror, which the music expresses with devastating directness. And that's especially true of the central triangle of disturbed and disturbing people at its heart. Mélisande, who's discovered by Golo in the forest outside the castle at the very start of the opera, but is ruined by jealousy over Mélisande's relationship with his half-brother Pelléas, whom he murders late in the opera. But who are these people? Do they belong in dream or reality? Is this story a fairy tale, however warped and twisted, or is it rather an intimate psychodrama? Debussy's music both reveals the story's twisted characters and swamps them with a sensual reality so that the real truth of this story seems to be found in the feelings that his music provokes rather than the actions of his characters. Well, that's at least how it feels to me when I hear this music. It's like having all your nerve endings exposed to a world of simultaneously seductive yet feverish feeling. But before we hear this performance recorded at the Vienna State Opera, and we'll have a brief break after the third act to recover our senses and our sanity, I'm delighted that Barbara Kelly from the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester is with us throughout to lead us through the emotional underworld of this opera and its forest, its castle and its dungeons. And there's no better guide to this music either. Barbara's written about what Pelléas et Mélisande symbolises for Debussy's music and for French music as a whole. Barbara, welcome. Look, where does Pelléas et Mélisande and its composition fit in the story of Debussy's life? Where was he with Pelléas?
Pelléas et Mélisande took a long time to come to fruition. They started it in 1893 after he'd come across Maeterlinck's play, and he was really determined to get the permission to write an opera on it. It took him, though, until 1902 to get it performed. So it comes at a really important moment in his career. If you think about Prélude à l'après-midi d'un faune, it's seen as the first sort of mature work. That was performed in 1894. So this starts it just a little bit before that, so still quite early in his career. By the time we come to 1902 with the premiere, he'd really become a very established figure, established in the sort of symbolist, literary, artistic and musical world.
What does he achieve here in terms of this new sound world that it still feels like to me when I hear this piece? I mean, how did it go down then? How should our ears be tuned into it just before we hear the first three acts of the opera?
Well, you talked about catastrophe. You also talked about its psychodrama and disturbing, and yet it's the gentlest catastrophe possible. It's noted by the silences, by the subtlety, by the hopelessness of the characters. So they might be disturbing. They're disturbing because they're lost in a world and they don't know really where they're from. So Mélisande is from Allemande, the idea of every world, nowhere. We don't really know. She's lost. She doesn't know where she's from. And neither does Golo, because he also says at the beginning, I'm lost too. So that idea of evocation and sensation, the subtlety of it, you have to tune in. I remember when I first heard Pelléas et Mélisande when I was much younger, it really bowled me over. It bowled me over by that beautiful subtlety.
So that means, Barbara, with that length of kind of compositional gestation, you know, he starts writing in his late 20s and it's premiered finally when he's in his mid to late 30s. I mean, that's a kind of crucial developmental period for him as a composer.
It is. It's a sort of coming of age, a maturity. And it caused a real sensation. He had a lot of support. He was part of a network of symbolists. And yet people didn't really know how to handle the opera. They didn't know what to make of it. And so there was real sort of polarization of factions that grew up around the opera. There were a group of real adherents who came to every single performance, and they were called the Apaches and centered around Ravel and his friends. And yet there were others who were protesting. And a protest came from the critics who thought that Debussy was writing this dangerous, sickly music that was unhealthy influence. There were also supporters of Maeterlinck, because Maeterlinck became very upset with Debussy and started sending out leaflets at the dress rehearsal, and that really provoked a scandal. We forget about the scandal of Pelléas because of Le Sacre de Printemps a number of years later, but there was a scandal, there was a riot.
Equivalent, or maybe greater than that, at Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, because, I mean, the Pelléas scandal, you know, it rolled on and on, didn't it? It wasn't just one performance.
It wasn't one performance, and it really divided the critics, and it divided the musical public. So there are probably just as many words spilt over Pelléas and Mélisande as there were over the Rite of Spring.
Barbara, thank you for now. And that's a wonderful way of preparing us for this ongoing, gentle, subtle catastrophe of this piece, whose shock we should still feel and we're going to feel right now. So let's hear the first three acts of Pelléas et Mélisande. Golo finds Mélisande alone in the forest at the start of the opera. They get married, but his ever-growing jealousy about her relationship with Pelléas is the lowering underscore to everything we hear in these three acts, from the forest to King Arkell's castle, where Pelléas is enchanted by Mélisande's Rapunzel-like hair, to a cave by the sea. You'll find a full plot synopsis of Pelléas and Mélisande on our website. And this Austrian radio recording is brought to us courtesy of the European Broadcasting Union. Simon Keenlyside sings the role of Golo, Olga Besmertner is Mélisande, and Adrian Erod is Pelléas, with Bernarda Fink as Geneviève. The orchestra of the Vienna State Opera is conducted by Anna Altinoglu. Pelléas and Mélisande.
Thank you. Je suis dans la forêt, je vous ai des incendies. troisième jour qui suivra cette lettre allumine l'homme sommet de la cour qui regarde l'homme.
Ce que le retour de ton frère n'en fait pas mieux. Et maintenant, Un grand navire, les lumières sont très hautes, nous le verrons tout à l'heure quand il entrera dans la bande de clarté.
Il y a encore une prise sur la mer.
Lorsqu'il fait trop chaud dans les jardins, on étouffe aujourd'hui.
a plus.
Comme le sol ici, on n'entend rien.
Il y a toujours un silence extraordinaire. On entendrait dormir l'eau. Voulez-vous vous asseoir au bord du bassin de Marne? Il y a un tilleul où le soleil n'entre jamais.
Je vais me coucher sur le monde, je voudrais voir le fond de l'eau.
On ne l'a jamais vu, elle est peut-être aussi profonde que la mer.
Si même chose au plus profond, on
devrait être calme. Ne penchez pas ainsi.
Je me touche
à l'eau. Calme de m'ici. Je vais vous venir par la main.
Je voudrais y plonger le dévot.
Venez, vous reviens-vous
Je ne sais pas se résister. Et il était, n'est-il pas là? Que
sont autour des branches. Ils se sont approchés dans l'obscurité. Attends, attends, il fait étoile. Que faites-vous ici?
Ce que je fais ici, je...
Vous êtes des enfants. Mélisande, ne te penche pas ainsi à la fenêtre. Tu vas tomber. Ne savez pas qu'il est tard. Il est près de minuit. Ne jouez pas ainsi dans l'obscurité. Vous êtes des enfants. Quels enfants? Quels enfants? Par ici, par ici. Vous n'avez jamais pénétré dans
Cela se répète. Elle est très délicate et il faut qu'on aménage d'autant plus qu'elle sera peut-être bientôt mère. Et la moindre émotion pourrait amener à malheur. Ce n'est pas le première fois que je remarque qu'il y a quelque chose entre vous. Vous êtes plus âgé qu'elle. Il suffira de vous l'avoir dit.
sans affectation d'ailleurs, sans affectation. Nous allons nous asseoir ici, Yolt, viens sur mes genoux. Nous verrons d'ici ce qui s'y passe dans la forêt. Je ne te vois plus du tout depuis quelque temps, et ma bande aussi. Tu es toujours chez petite mère. Nous sommes tout juste assis sous les fenêtres de petite mère. Elle fait peut-être sa prière du soir en ce moment. Mais dis-moi, Ignolte, elle est souvent avec ton oncle Pélias, n'est-ce pas?
Oui, oui, toujours, petite mère, quand vous n'êtes pas là.
Ah. Tiens, quelque passe avec une lanterne dans le jardin. Mais on m'a dit que ne s'aimait pas. Il paraît qu'il se querelle souvent. Non, est-ce vrai?
Oui, oui, c'est vrai.
Oui, ah, ah. Mais à propos de quoi se querelle-t-il?
À propos de la porte.
Comment? À propos de la porte, mais ce que tu racontes là?
Parce qu'elle ne peut pas être ouverte.
Tu ne veux pas qu'elle soit ouverte. Voyons, pourquoi te querelle-t-il?
Je ne sais pas, petite mère. À propos de la lumière.
Je ne te parle pas de la lumière, je te parle de la porte. Ne mets pas ainsi la main dans la bouche.
Voyons! Pleure! Je ne le ferai plus!
Voyons! Pourquoi pleures-tu maintenant? Qu'est-il arrivé?
Oh!
Oh! Pleure! Maman, le fais mal! Je te fais mal! Je te fais mal! C'est sans le vouloir!
Ici! Ici! En mon petit bras!
C'est sans le vouloir, voyons, ne pleure plus. Je te donnerai quelque chose demain.
Quoi? Tu perds?
Un pas de bois et des flèches. Mais dis-moi ce que tu sais de la porte.
Des grandes flèches?
Oui, de très grandes flèches. Mais pourquoi ne veulent-ils pas que la porte soit ouverte? Voyons! Réponds-moi à la fin. Non, non, n'ouvre pas la bouche pour pleurer. Je ne suis pas fâché. Pourquoi ne veulent-ils qu'on y ensemble?
Pélias, petite mère.
De quoi parle-t-il?
De moi, toujours de moi.
Mais que disent-ils de toi?
Il est dangereux, je suis le dragon.
Oh, misère.
aveugle qui cherche son trésor au fond de l'océan. Je suis ici comme un ours éperdu dans la forêt, et vous, voyons, ignote, je te distrais, nous allons causer sérieusement. Elle est à ces petites mères, ne parle-t-il jamais de moi? Moi, je ne suis pas là.
Si, si, mais tu pars.
Ah, et que disent-ils de moi?
Ils disent que je deviendrai
aussi grand que toi. Vous
êtes toujours près d'eux? Oui,
oui, toujours, mais tu pars. Ils ne te disent jamais d'aller jouer ailleurs.
Non, mais tu pars.
À quoi vois-tu qu'ils ont peur?
Ils pleurent toujours de l'obscurité.
Ah.
Cela fait pleurer aussi.
Oui, oui. Thank you.
The end of the third act of Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande. Golo's jealousy confirmed by his son, Inyold, and every character in the story, all of us listening, are compelled and swept up by this febrile intensity of Debussy's music, especially in this performance from the Vienna State Opera. Alaan Altinoglu is conducting, Simon Keenlyside sings the role of Golo, Olga Besmertner is Mélisande, and Adrian Erod is Pelléas. Well, after that, Barbara Kelly is our guide through this seductive yet kind of repellent emotional journey in this piece, especially the kind of cliffhanger that we've got to right now. That music we've just experienced is a rare explosion in the texture of this piece, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and the interpretation of it in this performance really draws out. Sometimes Inyold can sound a little helpless or lost, but in this particular production, you feel the cruelty of Golo. Golo is a character who's not completely all evil or all good, but this particular cliffhanger really gives an undercurrent of something sinister.
Thinking about this performance and what these voices are doing, I mean, of course, there are so many ways of singing, of imagining. Actually, the new kind of vocal writing that Debussy's going for in this piece, the sense that, precisely as you said, that everyone's a kind of ambiguous character. And in a way, the vocal writing, sometimes you feel he's going for something almost which has the directness of speech and yet it's sung. I mean, what did Debussy want from his voices? Did he want us to be feeling as if they were just talking to us, you know, that directness of communication? Was he going for something more melodramatic as well?
I think that's the most original element of the opera. His treatment of language really is trying to capture the flexibility of language, of the French language, which has a very, very slight stress, but is unlike many other European languages in not being a heavily stressed language. He's probably the first composer to capture that. And it's really that sensitivity to language that means that the characters are sort of responding in a very fluid way. There's very little lyrical writing. There's only one tune in the opera. And so on the face of it, it could be quite a difficult opera to listen to. And yet the way he plays the treatment of the text and the responsiveness of the orchestral support, it's very, very original, but at the same time suggests Wagner.
But then the weird thing is, like, you feel that the whole texture of the opera is somehow always lyrical. OK, it might not always have tunes in that kind of melodic sense, mm-hmm. but actually the whole opera has this feeling of floating, suspended lyricism somehow.
And that's carried, I think, in the orchestra. The motivic ideas that really underline the symbols of the rings, of the hair, of water, that's really in the orchestra. The orchestra creates that sort of web of symbols, and the melodic ideas are really connected in that way.
See, that suggests actually for all that this piece and for all Debussy himself wanted to move away from Wagner, that actually he's depended upon a kind of transformation of Wagner's leitmotifs in The Ring. I mean, a lot of this music seems to me, and we know we'd heard Parsifal by this time, a lot of it's almost like a droned version of Parsifal. Some of the rhythms are really very close. Even some of the, let's not call them melodies, then some of the motives are quite similar to what Wagner's doing in Parsifal. But you feel that the whole thing is somehow underwater. It's as if he's drowning Wagnerian technique at the same time that he's kind of indebted to it.
He's absolutely indebted to it. He's constantly complaining about Wagner, calling Wagner's use of leitmotif like a visiting card. At one point, he's aware of that influence and he says, I could see the ghost of old Klingsor and I had to start again. I had to rip it up and start again. So he's really, really self-conscious about developing something that isn't Wagnerian. And yet Wagner is very much at the basis of this. You're right about it somehow underwater. The orchestral treatment is very Wagnerian, but in some ways is more Wagnerian than Wagner was capable of doing. Wagner could not stop himself from letting the orchestra dominate. And yet Debussy keeps that at bay. He keeps it subdued, except in the interludes. Now, he had to extend the interludes during rehearsals.
Because he needed more time for scene changes.
Exactly. And it's at those moments that the orchestra really takes off. So that's where the sort of voluptuousness and a wonderful combination of Debussy's debt to Wagner comes through.
That's a wonderful thought, Barbara. Actually, this piece is the kind of ultimate Wagnerian music drama in the sense that Wagner wanted it to be theoretically, you know, that absolute symbiosis of word and music and drama together. Listen, we're going to hear now the very first Golo and Mélisande. Hector Dufresne as Golo and Mary Garden as Mélisande. What is this recording from the late 1920s? So obviously they're a bit older than when they sang it in 1902 at the premiere. Nonetheless, what does it tell us about Debussy's priorities for these particular voices and these roles?
It's wonderful to be able to get a sense of what those voices might have sounded like. Of course, we're relying on recording practices from a long time ago and also, as you say, voices that had aged since the premiere in 1902. But it does give us a clue. And Debussy was very happy with Mary Garden. She makes all sorts of claims about Debussy in her memoirs and they're sort of seen as unreliable. But he loved the slightly strange, well, foreign. She was Scottish. And that idea of her being slightly foreign and a little lost and malleable and quite passive, you can get a sense of that from these recordings.
Let's hear her. This is Act Two, Scene Two.
Oh, oh, tout va bien. Cela ne sera rien, mais je ne puis m'expliquer comment cela s'est passé. Je chassais tranquillement dans la forêt. Mon cheval s'est emporté tout à coup, sans raison. A-t-il vu quelque chose d'extraordinaire? Je venais d'entendre sonner les 12 coups de midi. Au deuxième coup, il s'est précipitamment écourt comme un aveugle fou contre un arbre. Je ne sais plus ce qui est arrivé. Je suis tombé et lui doit être tombé sur moi. Je croyais avoir toute la forêt sur la poitrine. Je croyais que mon cœur était déchiré.
Hector Dufresne as Golo and Mary Garden as Mélisande. Barbara, that's wonderful to hear those voices. And one of the key decisions that any casting director makes about this opera is who is Mélisande? You know, how young does she sound? Mary Garden's voice, it does have a kind of... It's rather unfashionable now in the casting of Mélisande, but it has a sort of childlike character in the way that she's inhabiting the words there.
Absolutely. It's a naivety about the voice, an unsophisticated element, and it's quite attractive. And it's very much in keeping with his idea, I think, of Mélisande.
And you hear in Hector Dufresne's just his way with the language. I mean, you feel, and again, of course, it's a recording and you understand how close they were to the microphones to record, but you feel that this is a kind of heightened speech in the way that they're delivering these words.
You do. And what's really interesting about his interpretation is that it's quite gentle in some ways. He doesn't seem that sinister. He seems to have a sympathy for her and a sensitivity to her. I think that's important.
There's something Debussy said when he was writing the piece. I guess he must have stopped composing just for a wee bit. And then he said he felt that Mélisande's sweet, morbid voice calling him, and Mélisande saying, "Look, there is no love like ours. You have to come back to me." It was definitely sweetness in Mary Garden there, morbidity perhaps not. And we've got another example, Barbara, we're going to hear. Another soprano who Debussy loved very much, the voice of Maggie Tate, accompanied here by Alfred Cortot, not in an extract from Pelléas et Mélisande, but one of his songs, Fantou. Debussy's relationship with Maggie Tate.
She worked with him for 9 months. She says that she rehearsed with him 3 hours a day for 9 months. He barely spoke to her. He supposedly never even shook hands with her. But she learnt so much from that intensive rehearsal.
Preparing to be the second Mélisande.
Yeah.
And she was another non-French soprano.
Supposedly, he says, not another Scottish woman. But actually, she's from Wolverhampton, so he hadn't got his geography quite right. But he was attracted again to her foreignness. That becomes part of the character. So the first two Mélisandes help to shape how that character becomes.
Well, here she is with Alfred Cortot in Fantouche. Fantouche from Debussy's Fête Galante, Maggie Tate, the soprano, and Alfred Cortot on piano. I mean, Barbara Kelly, it's really striking that, because you hear a combination of great clarity and great flexibility. That's not a kind of voluptuous voice of dimension or sensuality in that way, but she's doing a huge amount with the instrument, especially in combination with what Cortot's doing at the piano.
She's got a real delicacy in her sound and agility. She felt that he liked her voice and her interpretation because she was very faithful to the note values and she was very faithful to the text. She said that she used the example of having studied Mozart to help her interpret Debussy, which isn't an obvious thing to think about. And yet there is something about that agility, that dramatic pacing also, and the fidelity to what's written.
See, again, there's something about what Debussy obviously values as an interpreter, which is a kind of precision. In other words, in order to realise the dark, disturbing dream world of Pelléas et Mélisande, actually requires a kind of real clarity and precision to be realised on stage, to be realised in performance.
Every interpreter who who worked closely with Debussy, says the same thing. It's that respecting the composer's rhythm, not pulling it around, not turning it into a sort of mush, but that great clarity in the written flexibility, rhythmic flexibility of the writing.
What happens to Pelléas et Mélisande in the years, the decades after its premiere? Where do you feel its legacy resonating throughout the history, not just French opera, but opera in general?
It's an interesting question. It's a tricky question. In some ways, Pelléas et Mélisande is a one-off. Composers who tried to emulate it, to do something similar, got nowhere. If we think about Ravel, who was often seen as the quintessential imitator of Debussy, his two operas are very different, far away from the forests of Maeterlinck. I think what it does do, it's an opera that is thinking about how to write post-Wagner. It is thinking about the combination of the different elements of drama. Many composers subsequently had the same preoccupations. And also writers. If we're looking at that period, the Ballet Russe with Diaghilev, he was thinking about responses to Wagner. So we see it in ballet of that period. We also have playwrights such as Paul Claudel and also Jacques Copeau, who were trying in different ways to find the place for music. But sometimes the music was seen as really subservient. So I think it's taken a lot of the 20th century to play out those things. In terms of a legacy, operatic legacy for Pelléas, that's not clear. We get glimpses of it in perhaps in Messiaen and in certain composers subsequently. But there's a legacy in terms of Debussy as a composer who'd established himself as a quintessential French composer who was at the same time doing something very new. That really established his reputation. It established a sort of distinctiveness about French music, but the operatic legacy of Pelléas is not so clear.
I wonder if it takes us until around now to begin to come to terms with it. I'm thinking of George Benjamin's recent opera, Written on Skin, in which there is a similar, for the 21st century, a kind of melting and marriage of word and drama and the orchestra as subconscious. But it feels in a Debussy-like way in the terms of the way that all these things are mixed together. Also the way that the piece has become a real obsession of conductors and directors. Simon Rattle or Peter Sellers. I mean, this opera, once people love it, conductors, interpreters, singers, like Simon Keenlyside, who we're hearing as Golo in this performance. I mean, it seems to infect you as a performer, and you feel you have to keep coming back to it to try and answer the questions that are left unresolved by it. So you say, you know, we still don't know, nobody knows really, not even Debussy himself, who these people are.
You're right, it's still got an attraction. It might be, in some ways, very much of its time, a symbolist drama, and the text could have held it back. And yet, I think recently there was a poll about people's favourite operas, and Pelléas et Mélisande figures on really quite high up. And in some ways, I was surprised. I always thought that, you know, my sort of, not obsession, but fascination with Pelléas et Mélisande was just me being quirky. But actually, it is an opera that has got under people's skin, and each generation has its own interpretation, as we can hear from this performance.
Well, thank you, Barbara, for being with us. So to the denouement of this drama in Acts 4 and 5 of Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande. Act 4, Golo raves with jealousy and assaults Mélisande, whose innocence he can no longer trust. Pelléas and Mélisande confess their love for one another. Golo emerges from the shadows and murders Pelléas, his half-brother. In the fifth and final act, Mélisande is on her sickbed, having given birth to her daughter. Golo is racked by guilt. The child will live a sad existence, Mélisande says. And the room fills with silent serving women at the end of the opera who fall to their knees when Mélisande dies at the very end of the opera. A last redolent symbol in the litany of darkly dripping symbolism of this piece. Acts 4 and 5 of Pelléas et Mélisande from the Vienna State Opera. Simon Keenlyside is Golo, Olga Bezmertna is Mélisande, Adrien Erod, Pelléas. And the conductor is Alain Altinoglu.
Thank you. ce soir te verrai-je. Je sors de la chambre de mon père, il va mieux. Le médecin nous a dit qu'il était sauvé. Il m'a reconnu, il m'a pris la main et il m'a dit de cet air étrange qu'il a depuis, qu'il est malade. Est-ce toi, Elias? Tiens, je ne l'avais jamais remarqué, mais tu as le visage grave et amical de ceux qui ne vivront pas longtemps. Il faut voyager, il faut voyager. Si tu songes, je vais lui obéir. Ma mère l'écoutait pleurer de joie. Tu ne t'en es pas aperçu, toute la maison semble déjà revivre. On entend respirer, on entend marcher. Écoute, j'entends parler derrière cette porte. Vite, réponds vite, te dirai-je.
Où veux-tu?
Dans le parc près de la fontaine des aveugles. Veux-tu, viendras-tu? Ce sera le dernier soir. Je vais voyager comme mon père l'a dit. Il ne me verra plus.
Ne dis pas cela, Elias. Que les anges du ciel y célèbres sont. Mélisande, j'aurais presque peur. terre mia. Viens ici, plus près de moi. Je ne ris pas, ou bien je ris de joie sans le savoir.
Je ne trouvais pas la beauté, et maintenant je t'ai, je t'ai. n'entends plus respirer.
je l'ai vu, ne nous tout nous pas plus que moi.
Il a son épée.
Ce n'est pas la mienne.
Il a vu que nous nous sommes.
S'il ne sait pas que nous l'avons vu, ne bouge pas, ne tourne pas la tête, il se précipiterait. Je l'ai peut-être, il est encore immobile. Attends, attends, tout de suite, par ici. Je l'attendrai, je l'arrêterai. Attends, il a pris, il a
Je l'ai fait malgré moi, voyez-vous. te fait ton mal, Mélisande. Je ne puis pas te dire le mal que je t'ai fait, mais je le vois si clairement aujourd'hui, depuis le premier jour.
Thank you. la foi. Veux-tu enflammer les fenêtres?
Non, jusqu'à ce que le soleil soit au fond de la mer. Et si on rentre dans l'eau,
ces femmes viennent faire ici.
Ce sont mes servantes.
Yes, et qui les a appelées?
Ce n'est pas moi.
Que venez-vous faire ici? Personne ne vous a demandé.
Que venez-vous faire ici?
Mais qu'est-ce que c'est donc? Répondez!
Ne parlez pas trop fort.
Ne la troublez pas.
terrible, mais ce n'est pas votre faute. C'était la petite tête si tranquille, si timide et si silencieuse. Cette pauvre petite tête mystérieuse.
Another quiet catastrophe, another doom-laden prophecy, another round on this carousel of foreboding at the end of Debussy's opera Pelléas et Mélisande from the Vienna State Opera. Anna Altinoglu was the conductor, Simon Keenlyside sang the role of Golo, Olga Besmertner was Mélisande, Adrien Erod, Pelléas, Bernardo Fink was Genevieve, Franz Josef Zelig sang the part of King Arkel, and Marie Nazarova was Ineold, Marcus Peltz was the doctor, and Andreas Bettinger, Pelléas's father. After Mélisande's death, what sad fate awaits her daughter? And yet this music, the very final minute or so of that opera, is a place that I don't want to leave. It's the strange paradox of this piece. It's so enigmatic, so completely compelling. Barbara Kelly, you're still with us, but you've been our guide through this whole dark journey of Pelléas, and this is a strange place that we end. It is haunted and haunting.
Absolutely. Mélisande escapes, but actually it's the little one's turn next, and it actually says that in the text, that somehow the whole story will continue. There's quite a religious sense of the women somehow knowing the moment and falling on their knees at her death.
These silent, serving women who fall to the knees at the moment of Mélisande's death.